see skies of blue and clouds of white, bright blessed days, dark sacred nights, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Louis Schwartzberg, who's an award-winning cinematographer, director, and producer, who for three decades has created breathtaking imagery for feature films, television shows, documentaries, and commercials. He's won two Clio Awards for Best Environmental Broadcast Spot, an Emmy nomination for Best Cinematography for the Discovery Channel special Oceans of Air, and the Heartland Film Festival's Truly Moving Picture Award for Walt Disney Pictures feature film release America's Heart and Soul. Louis pursued a lifelong fascination with nature, running time-lapse cameras on flowers continuously 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for over 35 years, and spearheaded by the emergence of colony collapse disorder, the abrupt, inexplicable disappearance of entire worker bee populations from their hives. In 2005, he began a feature film about our relationship with plants and pollinators. This latest feature-length nature documentary, theatrically released worldwide by Disney Nature, is Wings of Life, narrated by Meryl Streep. And also joining us by phone is Charles Benbrook, who's research professor and program leader of Measure to Manage, Farm and Food Diagnostics for Sustainability and Health at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Louis Schwartzberg and Charles Benbrook.
It's great to be here.
And let me begin with you, Louis. You have provided us with this extraordinarily beautiful tableau of nature, and it's obviously something that all of our children should experience. And the film seduces you in the sense that it is about this seduction, this love affair between bees and butterflies and plants. And then later on we learn about the extraordinary importance of what we've seen as this, you know, festival of beauty. But there's a deep reality to it. And then, of course, the recognition and the realization that this whole cycle of life could be threatened. So it's an amazing, amazing film, and I thank you for it. You got started back in 2005. That must have been when people were first getting aware of this problem of what's called colony collapse disorder.
Yeah, when I heard about the issue of colony collapse disorder, it really motivated me to make the movie, because I've been shooting, as you said earlier, time-lapse flowers for almost 35 years nonstop. And you can't tell the story about the bees without telling the story about the flowers and how they co-evolved over 135 million years together. And this intricate, seductive relationship is at risk of unraveling because of man's, you know, input with things like, you know, pesticides and loss of habitat and stress on pollinators. And it's by far the most critical issue, I think, facing mankind at the present moment. But in order to tell that story, I really wanted people to fall in love with this incredible, beautiful, intricate, seductive relationship called pollination. You know, plants don't have legs. They can't move around to mate. So they've evolved this amazing strategy of seducing pollinators to move their pollen around, their DNA around, in order for them to reproduce. And, you know, without plants, we wouldn't have a third of the food we eat.
So, in other words, the fact that plants, and particularly flowers, are so colorful, that's a part of the seduction, right? That is what draws the pollinators in, so that the stigma and the stamen mean, or whatever, I can't remember from my biology class.
Yeah. Well, I've been fascinated by beauty, you know, and you kind of wonder, like, well, why are all babies cute? Why are kittens and puppies cute? I think that nature has hardwired us to protect what we fall in love with. And what the flower's strategy is, it's color, it's taste, it's smell, all these seductive, you know, tools to manipulate the pollinator to come and land on it and move its pollen around so that it can, you know, reproduce. It's an incredible, fascinating story, and it makes you appreciate the fact that it's the little things in life that make the world go round. It's the foundation of life on our planet.
And there are a lot of kids, of course, inner city kids, for example, who think that food comes from supermarkets. We have kids here in L.A., in South Central and other parts of L.A., that have never even seen the ocean 10 miles away. So as a teaching tool, what are you hoping? Because Disney's put out a teaching guide, have they not, online? Yeah. Just explain that to us.
Yeah, if you go to Disney.com, there's a 36-page study guide. And they've taken the same storytelling device that I did in the movie, which is basically I tell the story from the point of view of the flower. So we don't have this sort of, you know, anthropomorphized view on the outside looking in. It's from the flower's point of view and the pollinator's point of view. And that way, I think it really makes you understand and feel what it's like to be a flower or a pollinator.
It doesn't hurt to have Meryl Streep narrating it, saying that she is the voice of the flower, right?
It's really great because she's obviously a wonderful actress and most celebrated actress of our time, and also an English graduate student, so that she was very, you know, and a great gardener, I should say, as well. So she really loved working on this movie. And in addition, on my website, movingart.com, I've listed a lot of things people can do to help the pollinators, including some webinars we've done with different universities talking about the issue of pollination.
And you did a TED Talk, right, about this as well.
Yeah, we did it. I did a TED Talk, and what was really amazing is that the montage of that TED Talk went viral, and we've got over 30 million views, which is like six times larger than a number one box office trailer. So clearly, there's an audience out there that's interested, that wants to be seduced by all this beauty, and obviously, it's an important issue that we care about.
Let me bring in Charles Benbrook, research professor and program leader of Measure to Manage Farm and Food Diagnostics for Sustainability and Health at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. Chuck, give us your scientific reason. We've heard the artistic reason for why we should be engaged in understanding both the beauty of nature and how nature is being threatened in this very most fundamental way. Give us the science, if you will, around this mysterious colony collapse disorder.
My pleasure. First, let me say to Louis, I'm really looking forward to seeing this film, I'll tell you. Well, you know, people have heard the adage for many years that you have to watch out for canaries down in wells and mines. Well, you know, the health of our pollinators and bees are an equally important indicator of, you know, really what's going on at the interface between agricultural lands that are managed by farmers and often treated with a variety of production inputs and wild creatures that share the same ecosystem. There is something profoundly disturbing and worrisome about colony collapse disorder. The extent to which it has emerged as a global threat to pollinators is, you know, it's virtually unprecedented in our time to have such a critical problem appear seemingly out of the blue on essentially in most of the continents of the Earth. So it's a truly profoundly worrisome development, and I think what is behind it is the cumulative impact of a number of changes in how farmers manage their crops, but in particular how farmers control pests and the use of a certain new class of insecticides called the neonicotinoids, or nicotinols for short, really has. You know, there's accumulating evidence that shows that it's the emergence of all the ways that these nicotinols are being used by farmers that has kind of constituted the straw that broke the camel's back. One of the things that I'm sure Louis gets into in the film is how this is not just about the health of a single bee that goes out and is drawn by the beautiful bright colors of a flower to serve the pollination needs, but it's about this remarkable superorganism that is a beehive. A beehive is much more than the sum of the parts of all the individual bees that make it up. And I think what science is finally unraveling is the ways in which routine low-level exposures to a variety of chemicals, but in particular these nicotinols, can and does disrupt the integrity of this superorganism, which is a beehive, in ways that incrementally undermine the vitality and the ability of the bees within that hive at any particular time to deal with all the other sources of stress and bacteria and viruses that are a normal part of their environment. So this is an extraordinarily complex story that's unfolding, but certainly one we ignore at our peril.
Well, my understanding is that last year, half of the bees died off in the United States. Isn't that catastrophic? I mean, something's happening not just on an extraordinary scale, but happening quickly.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, obviously no one claims to have exact numbers on the percent of hives that are impacted, but typically beekeepers, you know, expect, you know, 15 to 25% of their hives to run into trouble over the winter and have to replace about that many. But since the emergence of colony collapse disorder, that average has kicked up to around half. There's many experienced long-term successful beekeepers that have lost 60 to 70% of their hives in over a single winter. So there's clearly something new and profoundly serious that's eroding the integrity of these hives.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to add one thing too, because, you know, Chip Taylor, who's head of Monarch Watch, reported that this year that the monarch population is the lowest it's ever been in 20 years since they've been monitoring it, and a lot of that he attributes to, you know, GMOs, the fact that these kinds of pesticides and GMO seeds are being spread throughout the Midwest is decimating the monarch population.
Well, there is a connection, is there not, Chuck Benbrook? It was sometimes in the demonstrations that took place against Monsanto over the weekend around the world, there was some confusion about the herbicides and insecticides. But my understanding is that even though it is mostly the Bayer insecticide, the neonicotinoid that has raised some flags and been the focus of concern, and that Roundup and other things are herbicides, which Monsanto produces. But my understanding is that Monsanto seeds are actually coated with this Bayer insecticide, this neonicotinoid. Is that your understanding?
Well, it's not my understanding. It's the fact. Essentially, all commercial corn, soybean, cotton, sorghum, wheat, seed that's planted every year by farmers, and whether they're genetically engineered seeds or not, but essentially the entire conventional seed supply today is treated with at least one nicotinol insecticide. These are potent and persistent systemic insecticides that actually move into the plant and are carried by the plant's vascular system. In effect, it's the blood system, circulatory system of the plant carries these nicotinols up through the architecture of the plant as it grows. And as a matter of fact, when a corn plant germinates from a seed treated with clothiodine or thiamethoxam, the two primary nicotinols that are used as seed treatments today, the concentration of those systemic nicotinols is highest in the first couple months as that corn plant grows. And what happens is corn plants, and indeed all plants, in the morning, they emit what's called gutation droplets, which it's in effect, people have termed it as plant sweat. It's a way that plants remove toxins that build up inside of them. It's a totally natural part of the plant cycle. But it turns out that these systemic insecticides that come from the seed treatments are being emitted by the plants in these gutation droplets, which happen to be favorite early morning sources of moisture for worker bees that have spent the night fanning the queen, working all night to preserve the integrity of the hive. They go out in the early morning, they're tired and they're thirsty, and they love these gutation droplets because, A, it's water, but, B, it actually has some nutrients that the bee needs from the nutrients the plant has pulled up from the soil. So this is a favored source of drinking water, but unfortunately, over the last 7 or 8 years now, across the United States and in most intensively farmed regions of the world, it's hard for a bee to find a field that hasn't been treated, where the seeds haven't been treated with one of these nicotinal seed treatments. And I think that it's this exposure through the seed treatment use that has really brought about the global scope of this, because it's not just corn and soybean and cotton seed in the United States. It's most of the seed in Europe. It's most of the seed in South America. It's the seed in the Far East. So it's really all over the world.
Well, it seems, though, that we're in a sort of deadly cycle, if you will, in terms of our chemical dependence on agriculture being chemically intensive, I guess is a way to put it, with both insecticides and herbicides being used in greater amounts. And my understanding is that the analogy is with human use of antibiotics, that the more indiscriminately you use antibiotics, the more likely you get antibiotic-resistant strains of TB, et cetera. So isn't that happening too? I mean, after all, it all comes down to Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, we are subjecting the weed populations in the United States. I mean, there's 185 million acres being sprayed with glyphosate herbicide this year. That's most of the corn, most of the soybeans, most of the cotton, significant chunks of other crops, alfalfa and sugar beets, where there's Roundup Ready varieties available now. So, you know, we're talking about over half of the farmland in the United States will be sprayed with glyphosate at least once, and probably it's pushing 1.75 applications per acre on average. So a lot of acres are getting treated twice, and some are getting treated three times. So the resistant weed populations that exist out in those fields, there may be only a few dozen resistant weeds in an acre, but those weeds will survive, and they will produce viable seeds. The water hemp plant and some of these other plants, they produce 200,000, 400,000 seeds per plant. And the rate at which they can spread is just really mind-boggling, especially if farmers continue to subject the growing population of resistant weeds to continuing selection pressure by still applying glyphosate herbicide, which is, of course, what farmers really have to do, because when they go to their seed dealer to buy corn seed, to buy soybean or cotton seed, all of the varieties, essentially the entire seed supply now, has embedded in it this Roundup Ready trait. And so in a way, farmers can't go to the marketplace and change their buying patterns and manage their way out of this. They have to rely on the seed industry proactively deciding that they're going to expand the supply of non-Roundup Ready seeds so that farmers can start to reduce their reliance on glyphosate herbicide, which is the underlying cause of the spread of the resistant weeds in the first place.
And Louis Schwarzberg, again, the filmmaker of this extraordinary feature-length nature documentary released by Disney, Nature, Wings of Life, narrated by Meryl Streep. The film begins with a reminder to us all that life depends on little things we take for granted. And just listening to Chuck lay out the science of what we're taking for granted and how much it's threatened, this couldn't be more important. I normally cover international relations and national security, but you could make an argument that what is more fundamental to our national security than the security of our food supply?
You can imagine there would be more than an environmental disaster. It's economic chaos. If a third of the food disappeared off the shelves, could you imagine what that would mean economically or politically, even to every country in the world? So I do believe that, and I agree with most scientists, this is the most critical issue facing mankind, bigger than global warming. If we lose this miraculous win-win relationship that evolved over 135 million years, we're never going to be able to recreate that. Even like the giant, you know, greenhouses that grow like 1/6 of the tomatoes we have in our country depend on a bumblebee to pollinate. And even agribusiness, with all the pesticides they're spraying out there, they still have to truck in bees, which, you know, in order to pollinate these flowers. We shot at an almond grove up in Tehachapi. It's like in the middle of the Mojave Desert, 10,000 acres of almond trees. That's a very unnatural thing. And the flowers bloom in February for like a week or two. They got to truck in millions of bees to pollinate these flowers, because if they don't get pollinated, there's no almond. So it's a billion, multi-billion dollar economic impact to the state of California and to countries around the globe that if the bees go, business goes, and we go.
And just in closing, Chuck Benbrook, do you see this in that kind of apocalyptic light?
Actually, I do, if nothing fundamental is done to start to reduce the incrementally greater reliance of farmers on more and more toxins to get crops through the season. It's just there's going to be a breaking point. You know, it's going to be bees, it's going to be birth defects in babies, it's going to be loss of a number of wild species. We have problems with the bat population for probably a lot of the same reasons. These nicotinols impair the immune response in all sorts of different organisms, from bees to bats, and so we have to take a fresh and unbiased look at what modern science has done to the our agriculture production systems. Yes, the yields have gone up tremendously. Yes, one farmer can manage hundreds, if not thousands, of acres of cropland, but the underlying system is really in jeopardy. And just one really critical point, as I'm sure Louis gets into in the film, imagine the difficult time the U.S. population would have, approximately doubling, if not tripling, its consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables, which we all need to do to combat overweight, obesity, and diabetes, are three major public health problems in the current generation. Imagine what a bind we would be in if we had to try to import most of our fresh fruits and vegetables from parts of the world that had not decimated their bee populations. It would be, as Louis pointed out, it would be true chaos.
Well, Charles Benbrook, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Benbrook, research professor and program leader of Measure to Manage Farm and Food Diagnostics for Sustainability and Health at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. And I've been speaking with Louis Schwartzberg, who's an award-winning cinematographer, director, and producer, who for three decades has created breathtaking imagery for feature films, television shows, documentaries, and commercials. Louis has pursued a lifelong fascination with nature, running time-lapse cameras on flowers continuously, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for over 35 years. And spearheaded by the emergence of colony collapse disorder, the abrupt, inexplicable disappearance of entire worker bee populations from their hives, in 2005 he began a feature film about our relationship with plants and pollinators. This latest feature-length nature documentary, theatrically released worldwide by Disney Nature, is Wings of Life, narrated by Meryl Streep. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.